Welcome to the podcast series for AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. I'm your host, Kara Hansel-Kehan. Today we'll discuss the article by Ogilvie et al. Titled, Hemodynamic Assessment of Diastolic Function for Experimental Models. This article was published April 21st, 2020. Joining me today are Deputy Editor Mary Lindsay, authors Leslie Ogilvie and Jeremy Simpson, and expert Michael Schubert. Let's get started.
Thank you, Kara. Leslie Ogilvie and Jeremy Simpson assembled a team to review current best practices in hemodynamic assessment of diastolic function for experimental models. Leslie, tell me, what was the impetus for writing this manuscript?
Thank you, Mary. The simple answer is that I'm fascinated by how the heart relaxes. One of the main ways we evaluate cardiac function is using invasive hemodynamics. Early on in my training, I started learning about diastolic function, mainly from working with others in our research group. My intention was to create a review that brought together all of the things that I'd learned about diastolic function to serve as the tool that I wish I had when I started.
I see. Well, definitely this is a timely topic. Mike, what is the significance of this review for the cardiovascular research community?
Mary, this is definitely a timely topic. There's a tremendous amount of clinical focus that's been growing on heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, which has a significant diastolic dysfunction component to the disease. There's also growing interest in sex differences in heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, or HFpEF, and that has been a big driver for a lot of the work in this area recently. But of course, we know diastolic dysfunction occurs also as a consequence of cardiac fibrosis, diabetes, and a host of other cardiovascular maladies. So the time is really right to start to look at this very carefully and determine what are the best ways to assess this. As a result, there's growing interest in the development of animal models of HFpEF, and including cardiac function in diabetes. And a key component of that is being able to measure diastolic function in animals. So this review provides a definitive and understandable guide to considerations in the assessment of diastolic function in both healthy and diseased animals.
Right. Definitely right now, diastolic function is on everyone's radar. Jeremy, I wanted to ask you, why do you think that diastolic functional assessments have lagged or at least received less attention than systolic functional assessments, especially in animal models?
Thanks, Mary. Fundamentally, I think we see the healthy heart as a pump capable of pumping blood to all organs of the body. For decades, patients with heart failure were characterized as having a weak pump or a weak heart, struggling to contract and produce force. The two main causes of heart failure, which are high blood pressure or myocardial infarction, when reproduced in animal models, recapitulates this weak pump. I remember myself when I was learning how to evaluate cardiac function by invasive hemodynamics during my PhD and postdoctoral fellowship. Almost exclusively, the foundational studies, largely published in the 80s and 90s, which laid the groundwork of how to evaluate cardiac function, were generally focused on systolic function. This wasn't surprising. At the time, there wasn't a reason to focus on diastolic function. However, with time, things have changed. We now have a reason. Diastolic function has emerged as being equally important to systolic function in the overall ability of the heart to function as a pump. This is driven by the clinical observation that a large portion of patients with heart failure arises from impairments in diastolic function. Critically, we have no effective therapies at all to address this type of heart failure. So there's a lot of interest in how best to characterize and understand diastolic function.
You're right. It's definitely easier to measure systolic function when you have a sledgehammer effect, such as MI. But right now, there's so much more awareness of the caresses of diastolic dysfunction. And definitely, those are more intricate measurements. So speaking of challenges, Leslie, what are the main differences and challenges faced when measuring diastolic function in small animal models, such as rats and mice, especially compared to humans?
Well, the first challenge is just getting the catheter in. Mice have tiny hearts. In our paper, we presented a number of factors that affect the accuracy of measuring cardiac function. One of the things I find most surprising in mice is their ridiculously high heart rates. These higher heart rates in rodents require a greater sampling rate than what we would use in humans to make sure that we aren't losing signal integrity. What's interesting is that the diastolic parameters seem to be more sensitive to signal loss at low sampling rates, whereas systolic parameters generally aren't as affected. To add on that, while cardiac function in humans and rodents is affected by core body temperature, mice are way more susceptible to anesthetic-induced hypothermia. We have to pay much more attention to maintaining body temperature in rodents to prevent artifacts in cardiac function. And Mary, I could go on for an hour about respiration, but I'll make one more comment. I often hear the phrase respiratory artifacts when evaluating cardiac function, but I'd like to suggest that we think of respiration as an influence rather than an artifact, because respiratory and cardiac systems are anatomically and functionally linked.
Leslie, along those lines, your paper mentions considering diastolic function as two phases, relaxation and filling. Why do you think this distinction is so important to make?
Great question, Mike. Diastolic function can be assessed by multiple parameters. Some of these parameters, such as DPDT min and tau, reflect how the heart relaxes, while other parameters, such as EDP, reflect compliance or the filling phase. We feel that there's no one parameter that's sufficient to explain diastolic function in heart failure. In fact, each parameter often follows its own unique pattern over time, where all the parameters are not in agreement until overt failure. We don't yet have a detailed understanding of the molecular mechanisms underlying both phases, but we certainly see evidence that they're not entirely dependent on one another, so we need to capture both phases of diastole. But in our lab, we believe that not all diastolic dysfunction is the same, and by measuring all these parameters, we can more accurately characterize how dysfunction develops.
That's a very cool concept, that diastolic dysfunction does not necessarily mean the same thing under all cases of pathology. I hadn't really thought of that aspect. Coming back to the analysis issues, Jeremy, how do automatic software algorithms complicate the accurate assessment of diastolic function?
Computers don't have cognitive abilities. They function based upon mathematical models, which have assumptions. Algorithms don't deal well with noise or conflict within their assumptions. If we don't understand the limitations of the algorithms, we risk making mistakes by either not seeing something that is there or drawing erroneous conclusions that are not based on true physiology. In our review, we highlight some of the issues in algorithms that we think researchers should be aware of in their own evaluation of diastolic function.
Those are all great points. And how do you see the field moving forward to improve diastolic measurements?
That's a great question, Mary. I'd like to propose two things I would like to see in the field. One, I'd like to see a greater number of studies include raw physiological data sets, at least as supplements. And the second change I'd like to see is something that we fundamentally do all the time when we run ELISAs or do Western blots. In our labs, we always have students run calibrator curves, use some sort of a calibrator data set.
Jeremy, those are all good points. And as you know, AJP Heart and CIRC is very interested in rigor and reproducibility and being the yardstick in the community for establishing, you know, guidelines and best practices. Certainly, you know, keep us apprised of your progress in the area of standardization, because we would certainly be interested in any manuscripts that you produced regarding that topic.
So Jeremy, this discussion on algorithms and methods of assessing diastolic function leads to, I guess, a bigger picture question, which is, do you feel that there are good rodent models of human diastolic dysfunction, particularly in the setting of heart failure with preserved ejection fraction?
Thanks, Mike. That's an excellent question. Emerging HFpEF models are very exciting to read, along with the commentaries. We certainly have seen a number of models being proposed over the last few years, and I would say we're still building the foundations in these models. And I think the jury is still as which HFpEF model is the quote-unquote correct model. However, I wonder if we missed a huge opportunity by focusing on trying to find this elusive unicorn model for a disease that we don't fully understand clinically yet. The main distinction between HFrEF and HFpEF is based upon the preservation of ejection fraction as measured by echo, which is really the dilatation of the left ventricle. Based on the measures used to assess function, clinically, both HFrEF and HFpEF show evidence of systolic and diastolic dysfunction. I'm not sure of a HFrEF model that starts and stays as one of pure systolic dysfunction. The two most common models of HFrEF, which are transverse aortic constriction and AMI, have profound diastolic dysfunction that arises very early on and almost in concert with development of systolic dysfunction. Yet research and development of therapeutics has mainly focused on systolic dysfunction.
That's a really good point, Jeremy, focusing on basically the properties of the model rather than what term you're using for the model is probably a better approach in terms of understanding how physiology and pathology link. Leslie, can you provide a simplified overview of the significance of tau or its variance in the assessment of diastolic function?
Absolutely. For me, this was one of the most confusing measures of diastolic function. The unit of tau is time, but it isn't the time per se. It's the time constant of relaxation. Many years ago, Weiss looked at the relaxation phase of the cardiac cycle and theorized that this part of the curve could be modeled by an exponential decay. If you then linearize an exponential decay, of course you get a straight line, and the slope of that line is the inverse of tau. This is the time constant of an exponential decay. The reason Weiss was interested in finding another parameter to assess relaxation is because dPdt min is load dependent, and he predicted that tau would be less so. This is important as we often compare two different groups that don't have the same loading conditions. So when we find a difference between these groups, we want to attribute that difference to the intrinsic function of the heart and not simply to differences in preload, afterload, or heart rate. Now you've probably heard names like Weiss, Glantz, and Logistic associated with tau, which further complicates things. For one, Weiss and Glantz are both exponential models of tau, but use slightly different math equations to linearize the data and get the slope, which again is the inverse of tau. The biggest difference is that Weiss assumed that LV pressure decayed to zero, while Glantz used a mathematical model that took into account differences in the minimum LV pressure. Therefore, we should only use Weiss for in vitro models, such as a Langendorf, while Glantz should be used for in vivo models. Another difference in the iterations of tau is that Weiss and Glantz believed LV pressure decayed to a monoexponential, while tau logistic isn't named after a research group, but after the math model used, the logistic decay. The difference is that in an exponential model, relaxation is assumed to follow a uniform rate of pressure decay throughout the entire relaxation process, whereas in the logistic model, the rate of pressure decay slows as we approach minimum pressure or nearing the end of isovolumic relaxation. The authors propose that this is the best equation to model physiological systems.
Leslie, that was a great comment. I was going to ask you about whether the different ways of calculating tau made a difference, and certainly it seems that it does because of the way that dPdt changes as a curve and not as a line. So thank you very much for clarifying that.
Well, certainly this review article should be required reading for all trainees in cardiovascular research. There's just so many avenues of interesting commentary and discussion of all the considerations that go into making diastolic measurements. Leslie Ogilvie and Jeremy Simpson, AJP Heart and Circ, thank you for submitting this review. Mike Schubert, thank you for discussing it with us. Back to you, Kara.
Thanks for listening. Would you like to hear more? Visit the AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology homepage for our latest episodes.